Last week on Freakonomics Radio, we started looking at where creativity comes from. For instance, how much does your family matter?
Yeah, I'd grown up around the music. So my father and them played, they listened to their music. No one else was listening to it, but I heard it.
That's Wynton Marsalis, the trumpeter who runs the celebrated Jazz at Lincoln Center program. The filmmaker Mark Duplass talked about a different way that family mattered.
Our parents gave us a lot of emotional support and a lot of love, but they didn't buy us a lot of stuff. So we were very bored. That's when HBO came into our lives, and that really lit us up as storytellers.
We also looked at how well you can predict someone's creativity.
This factor is so powerful that you can actually tell by going to someone's dorm room in college.
The psychology professor Dean Simonton told us that creative geniuses often have a key personality factor, an openness to new experiences and ideas. We also looked at the relationship between creativity and schooling with the psychologist Teresa Amabile.
I think that the biggest mistake we make in our schools, and I'm talking about everything from kindergarten now up through college, is to focus kids too much on how their work is going to be evaluated.
This week, how can we help kids be more creative?
I think the most important creative experiences come when kids are actively engaged in making new ideas through their interactions with the world.
Should we encourage creativity in our children?
I mean, let me put it this way. I am a person for whom being creative is terrifying.
Plus, our conversation with one of the most prolific, versatile, and beloved musicians of the past few decades, Elvis Costello.
What do you think you would have done, though, had it not worked out?
I just never had any doubt that I would do it something eventually. It never occurred to me.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything, with your host, Stephen Dubner.
I think we all see kids who are slightly rebellious, who talk back, who question the teacher.
That's Walter Isaacson, who's written biographies of Steve Jobs, Leonardo da Vinci, Benjamin Franklin, and Albert Einstein. We heard from Isaacson at the end of last week's show.
And at a certain point, the teacher either spends more time and lets the imagination wander, or punishes them and says, you know, quit questioning me. Einstein ran away from his school in Germany because he was expected to learn by rote, and he was, swatted down every time he tried to question the teacher. So he was lucky. He gets to run away and go to Switzerland, where they have a new type of school system that nurtures questioning authority.
One institution that has raised the questioning of authority to an art form is the MIT Media Lab. It has research units called Opera of the Future and Biomechatronics and Lifelong Kindergarten. That last one is run by a professor of learning research.
Okay. My name is Mitch Resnick.
Resnick argues that randomized controlled experimentation, the gold standard of a lot of science, just doesn't work very well for a subject like creativity.
One problem with it is it changes one variable at a time. And I don't think any one variable is going to be the key to creativity. So I think that what we see is the most creative environments have lots of different things that work together in an integrated way. So it's really not so easy to take the classic approach of make a tweak in one variable and see the changes. I don't think is going to be the way that we're going to get a deeper understanding of the creative process.
Resnick argues that the lack of clear, quantifiable outcomes is a big reason why schools don't prioritize creativity.
Schools end up focusing on the things that are most easily assessed rather than focusing on the things that are most valuable for kids and valuable for thriving in today's society. So what we need to do is to focus more on trying to, assess the things we value rather than valuing the things that are most easily assessed.
Resnick and the Lifelong Kindergarten Group develop software that lets kids make things like animated stories or interactive Lego models.
Very often, traditional learning has taken the form of delivering information, delivering instruction. And the view has been if we just find a better way to deliver the instruction, kids will learn more. But I think research has shown that, you know, learning happens when kids, and adults for that matter, actively construct new ideas. You know, there's the expression, we get ideas. We don't get ideas, we make ideas. So I think that, yes, there's some role for just, you know, delivering information, but I think the most important creative experiences come when kids are actively engaged in making new ideas through their interactions with the world.
The program is called Lifelong Kindergarten because Resnick thinks the ideas should extend well beyond childhood.
We focus on four guiding principles that I call the four P's of creative learning: projects, passion, peers, and play. So we feel that the best way to support kids developing as creative thinkers and developing their creative capacities is to engage them in working on projects based on their passions, in collaboration with peers, in a playful spirit. We lead most of our lives by working on projects. You know, a marketing manager coming up with a new ad campaign is work on a project. A journalist writing an article is work on a project. In our personal life, we plan someone's birthday party. That's a project. So we want kids to learn about that process of making projects. We also want them to work on things that they're passionate about. We've seen over and over that people are willing to work longer and harder and persist in the face of challenges when they're working on things they really care about. They also make deeper connection to ideas when they're working on projects that they really care about. The third P of peers, we've seen that learning is a social activity, that the best learning happens in collaboration and sharing with others. We learn with and from others. And then the final P of play, I sometimes call the most misunderstood P. Often when people think about play, they just think about fun and laughter. I have nothing against fun and laughter, but that's not the essence of what I'm talking about. I see play not just as an activity, but a type of attitude, an approach for engaging with the world. When someone has a playful approach, it means they're constantly experimenting, trying new things, taking risks, testing the boundaries. And I think the most creative activities come about when we're willing to experiment and take risks.
I remember when I would come home from school and no one was home and I didn't have a plan, there was this kind of almost mysterious excitement that I would feel about just being alone.
That's the writer Jennifer Egan, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad.
I have to say, I feel like I lost touch with that through maybe even decades of my life, where I was so worried about what everyone else was doing, how I measured up, how what I should be doing as opposed to what I was doing, whether there was some important thing everyone else was doing that I should be doing too. And this was before social media. I think this is like a scourge for young people now, from everything I hear. But if I can get that out of my head, which I find easier and easier as I get older, there's a feeling that there's sort of a mystery that's waiting for me that I can possibly enter. There's so many childhood narratives that are really about this. I mean, The Secret Garden, all of the Narnia books, you know, about passing through a membrane or a border or a door or jumping into a pool and being in another world. It's a really basic, fantastical longing, this wish to be at a distance from one's own life and to touch something outside it, which is first of all thrilling in and of itself, and second of all returns you to your real life and charged in some way. That's what fiction writing does for me.
Well, I think that when we're young, we really indulge our wonder years.
Walter Isaacson again.
You know, that a notion of playing and being imaginative and having downtime where you can be creative, that's something we sometimes lose in our school systems today.
One beneficiary of this creative downtime? Leonardo da Vinci.
He had the great fortune to be born out of wedlock, which meant that he couldn't go to one of the Latin schools that middle-class families of the Renaissance went to. And so he's self-taught. He sits by a stream and puts rocks and different obstacles in it to see how the water swirls. Then he draws it, and then he looks at how air swirls. All of these things you get to do when you're young, you're full of wonder, and you're using your imagination. We see that in Ben Franklin as a young kid, just being interested in why does condensation form on the outside of a cold cup? the type of thing that maybe we thought about, but somehow we quit thinking about. So that's the number one secret of being imaginative and creative, is almost being childlike in your sense of wonder. Albert Einstein said that. He said, I'm not necessarily smarter than anybody else, but I was able to retain my childlike sense of wonder at the marvels of creation in which we find ourselves.
But Walter Isaacson, like Mitch Resnick and Teresa Amabile, isn't calling for a ban on conventional instruction.
I think that creativity is something you can nurture and even try to teach. But more importantly, creativity without skill, creativity without training and learning can be squandered. If Louis Armstrong had not found somebody, King Oliver, to teach him how to play the cornet, all of his imagination would have been lost. So we should not disparage the role of training, of learning. I mean, the same is true of Einstein. As a little kid, he's wondering how the compass needle twitches and points north. What's kind of important that he goes to the Zurich Polytech and starts understanding the concepts behind Maxwell's equations. So people who think we should just nurture creativity without the skill sets and the training that allow creativity to be turned into action, to allow for things like applied creativity, they're being too romantic about it. Leonardo had to work in Verrocchio's workshop and learn how to do a brushstroke.
There are, of course, plenty of obstacles that may keep a person from gaining both proper instruction and the latitude to play and imagine. Here's John Hodgman, the comedian, author, and former Daily Show correspondent.
People who are hand-to-mouthing it and are really economically anxious, of course they're going to have a disadvantage to, say, an affluent white dude from Brookline, Massachusetts, who was an only child who had the full benefit of all of his parents' love and never had to share anything in his life. Like, I had a lot of time to sit around thinking and daydreaming, you know, to the point where when I went to college, you know, my dad said, I don't care what you do in college. I ask you only that you take a single course in bookkeeping and finance so you know how that world works. And I was like, Dad, I love you, but no way. I was like,
really?
Even that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that wasn't a big ask on your father's part.
I know.
What a spoiled brat you were.
Oh, totally.
Seriously, this John Hodgman.
No, this is what I'm saying. I've regretted it every day of my life. But, you know, but it was an incredibly selfish and ridiculous thing to do, because I was spending his money to go to college. And yet I was like, no, I'm going to sit on the grass and read 100 Years of Solitude for the fifth time. You could make an argument that it paid off for me to a certain degree. But I mean, look, art comes out of all communities everywhere. Communities of means and communities of no means. I mean, the greatest art movement of the 20th and 21st century, that is probably the most globally meaningful art movement, is the development of hip hop, which was a creation in the South Bronx by young people who were obviously not affluent.
John Hodgman sure sounds like he's got a grip on the causes and consequences of creativity, wouldn't you say? And that he's got his own creative ducks in a row. He's had a lot of creative and commercial success. But do not be deceived. If you think prior success insulates a creative person from, well, anything, you should think again.
I mean, let me put it this way. I am a person for whom being creative is terrifying. It is the most rewarding thing that I can do, but it is a constant struggle with a very clear feeling that I am out of gas every day, and that I will not be able to support myself or my family because I have now finally run out of ideas. For sure, this time I mean it. It's not even a fear. It is a certainty that I'm done, that I have no further ideas. And I've been doing this, and this and only this, whatever this is, now for 21 years.
We will explore that fear and many other aspects of creativity in future installments of this series. You can listen for those over the coming months. Coming up after the break, we speak with Elvis Costello about his new record and what he's been doing since the last one.
I started to claim that I was actually ordained at one point. You know, it was a sort of semi-invented character I was playing.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at cysimsfoundation.org.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance with a Name Your Price tool, providing information on a range of insurance coverage and price options. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Elvis Costello has been making excellent records since the mid-1970s, records that range from punkish pop to super dense super pop to country and western, from earnest to sardonic. He's particularly adept at bringing a postmodern flair to the elegant foundations of the old school songbook style. And that's what he's done on his newest record, which is called Look Now. Just how versatile is Elvis Costello? Over the years, his collaborators have included Burt Bacharach, the Brodsky Quartet, Anne Sophie Von Otter, Paul McCartney, the Charles Mingus Orchestra, and Alan Toussaint. If you're at all a serious fan of popular music, Elvis Costello has at least been on your periphery for several decades. For a time, he was nearly very, very famous. But to those who love his music, he's way better than famous. He's an original, a musician's musician, a writer's writer. He's also got the rare ability to create music that is both high-minded and open-minded. And as you'll hear now, he does that in conversation as well. If you would just say your name and what you do, however you'd like to describe that.
Hello, I'm Elvis Costello, and I'm some kind of musician and a writer.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with your new record, which I love. Congratulations.
Thank you. I think it's
remarkable. It's rich and dense, but also gritty and funny, and it's modern and traditional, and it's a record that no one in the world but Elvis Costello could have written.
Well, that's a pretty good compliment. But that's kind of what I hoped to do, to be really truthful, was I had these songs. Some of them I'd written a while ago. Some of them were written in collaboration. Some of them were written very recently. And I knew that they were songs that would be served by my band, mm-hmm. but they would give us an opportunity to show everything that we can do, not just one aspect of, you know, a four-piece rock and roll band is often just asked to be a four-piece rock and roll band. And that's great fun. But it's also great to be able to bring to anything that which you've learned, that which you've come to understand, be able to kind of quiet yourself to the mood of a ballad. And in this case, play in collaboration with Burt Bacharach. You know, I couldn't have imagined us pulling that off 20 years ago or longer.
He was wild, dynamite. And she was rare as treasure. That's not the kind of story you deny.
You write in the liner notes, I wanted to make a record that we couldn't have made back then.
Yeah, there's no point in really. There's never, to me, there's never been any point in making the previous record again.
Yeah.
So each one has, to my ear, been quite different. I mean, to people who don't hear those increments change or don't have the same appreciation, probably all my records sound the same, but they're tuned to different things than I am. And the great thing is we're totally spoiled for choice. You know, we have so much stuff we can listen to from the past, from the present. Stuff that's, you know, secret stuff that's right in the headlines. You don't have to have one above the other. It isn't necessarily a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And one of the only, you know, positive things about the changes in the way music is heard is that the hierarchical aspect of it is sort of become less oppressive There are still people that sell massive amounts of records and people are obsessed with those achievements. But some of the most interesting things are happening in little corners. And that's not to say, well, I'm making the best of it because I used to sell records and now there aren't records to sell. It's just that that's the way it is. I find that the records that really interest me by other people, whether they're people of my generation or whether they're brand new artists, they tend to be things you stumble upon. And it reminds me of how wonderful it was to feel as if you had personal possession of a record that nobody else knew about, which was the way it was when I started out.
So why so long between records? I'm just curious. You know, Elvis Costello is a musician that those who love him very, very, very much. And yet you've never been the mega-sized star that you threatened to become once years ago. And I'd like to talk about that.
It was threatened by other people upon you, perhaps. I made a conscious decision about the use of my time at 2010, 2011. I had an enforced little bit of time off. I released a record in 2010, which I really loved.
Third class ticket in his pocket, punching out the shadows underneath the socket, tweed coat turned up against the fog.
It didn't seem to demand that the music be played live. There was no demand for me to perform those songs. And it coincided also with my father's passing, and it's maybe that sort of just made me take stock. And I started to think that maybe records were a vanity that I shouldn't indulge.
Of an indifferent nation, waiting on a platform at a Lancashire station. Somebody's calling you again. The sky has fallen. Jim is standing in the rain.
You know, that brought home how limited time was. And with having young children, I decided that if I was going to be away from home, I had better really be bringing home my share of our family income. And so it was a much more certain bet to go out and play concerts. And I also felt that maybe I had an opportunity. Now I really did have too much material for one evening of songs, that I could create shows that, you know, I ended up creating two or three shows, stage shows I'm talking about. They weren't elaborate productions with huge, you know, expensive values. They were cheap carnival tricks that I used to frame what I had, which is my songbook. The first one was called A Spectacular Spinning Songbook. It was a revival of a show I did first as a kind of dare in the mid-80s.
We're going to read off some of the titles on the Spectacular Spinning Songbook. Tonight, we have Every Day I Write the Book.
Where we used a game show wheel to select the next song, and I had a beautiful assistant like a magician does.
And it was
real,
not rigged?
It was real. It was real.
Spin that wheel. Radicals! Radicals when it stops. No!
I mean, sometimes we rigged it towards the end of the show to get a number to get off stage, but no, we let it go as it was, and it was a tremendous challenge for the band because they had to know something like 150 songs at the drop of a hat, and you could get a run of three finale numbers to open the show, and then you'd have to find how you could continue the mood, you know. everything conceivable happened. You'd have people that would come up, and, you know, we had very good cast members. You know, we had a dancer who was really sympathetic. She was really good. She was doing a parody of like a go-go dancer. Some people weren't terribly certain that they didn't realize the whole thing was a satire. They thought we were actually serious. And the whole point of it was to bring people on the stage and invite them. You never could guess how many people really want to be a go-go dancer, you know. And there were people on stage who should never dance that did. And that's a great moment, you know, because I'm the worst dancer in the world. So, you know, I really have sympathy for people come up, but they threw themselves into it, and we had some very nice, you know, we'd have, you know, mothers and sons come up and do it together, and married couples. We had one guy propose to his fiance. I started to claim that I was actually ordained at one point. You know, it was a sort of semi-invented character I was playing. It was partly me and partly this character I was inhabiting. And I applied myself to finishing a book I'd been working on for 12 years called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. And I then worked up another show over a couple of tours where I gradually gathered props, started out with an on-air light like you find in an old radio studio, like the kind I saw when I would go with my dad to the radio broadcast. And then I added a television set, which had a screen onto which I could project cues to the songs. Sometimes they were old advertisements, sometimes they were family photographs. I could also get inside this TV and appear, as it were, on television on the stage. And it was, again, semi-theatrical, semi-scripted. The anecdotes that I told by way of introduction were sort of frivolous versions of more serious stories that appeared in the book. Sometimes the manuscript version was a lot more heartbreaking, and I would tell like a lighter-hearted version. A lot of the things were about, some of the things about family were quite dark, you know. There were some things about my parents' relationship, my dad's sort of more wayward nature, which I sort of unfortunately inherited for a period of my life. And so, you know, I suppose I was working all of that stuff out, but because it was all in the songs already, and all I did was sort of like point people to maybe what they had only suspected about the songs.
But the book I gather is real to the core. Yes, everything in the book is you.
Yeah,
your songs are all, as far as I know, copywritten Elvis Costello. Your book, however, is copywritten by your given name, Declan McManus.
Some of my songs are copyrighted. I changed it for a little while, and then I found that when people wanted to write with me or do my songs, of course, nobody had any idea who Declan McManus was, so they wanted an Elvis Costello song. You know, I mean, again, that's one of those things that I did kind of as just a little marker. It's a gift to music critics to see something like that, because they want to read all sort of psychological significance into it. It really isn't that. You know, I was aware of the fact that the brand of my original appearance on the music scene was quite that. It was a brand in some people's view, even though to me it wasn't. It was my life. And the name was idiotic and the appearance was idiotic. You know, I played up to it and I lent into the character that was sort of invented around me. But then after a little while, that gets a bit boring. And it gets dangerous as well. You know, you start to live it out and make the wrong choices in so many different ways. So you got to get out of it. So maybe part of it was reasserting, you know, there was a person who was like completely on the outside of all of this ridiculous showbiz stuff that made the little tapes that got me my first record. You know, I mean, I was making those in my bedroom. I still sing some of the other songs that I was writing then. It was just the few that caught people's ear were the ones that coincidentally landed me in the studio right when this supposed new thing was happening in rock and roll. You know, I mean, I never really identified myself with it. Other people said, you're part of this new wave thing. That was just a label somebody made up as a matter of convenience. It wasn't a game plan, you know.
You did seem to recognize even then that, I remember I guess this was in your book maybe, you wrote, the squarer I look, which I gather is English for angrier, yes? The angrier I look, the more the camera likes it. How much of early on was you kind of putting on a creative persona?
I think it was a sort of, I saw an interview with Wayne Shorter in a documentary about Lee Morgan, where he talked about drinking brandy when he was younger, and he said it just created a little kind of place around himself in which he did his work. It wasn't like he was really getting lit. It just took him out of the immediate environment. I understood exactly what that was, even though I'm a very different type of musician. Obviously, I'm not on that same level, but I'm not an improviser in that way. But I know that I did the same thing with aspects of the persona the fact that I didn't speak on record at times, it all just created a bit of room around me to get on with the job without being interrupted.
Oh, is that what it was?
It was just that.
It wasn't.
And
that
also,
you needed...
I was probably just anxious and nervous as well, because I actually by nature quite shy. And then you have to learn bravado. And of course, bravado easily, you know, then you get challenged, particularly by boring, self-satisfied people, whether it be like a radio DJ or a journalist that thought they'd worked you out. That, of course, you push it to a greater extreme just to confound them, just to horrify them more, you know. And hence you have those big standoffs, you know, with the Sex Pistols and somebody on TV. Well, it never got to that stage, really. Mostly I could handle the situation. And then also some people who were very kind. There were some older journalists. There was a woman journalist from Wales who interviewed me very early on. And I hadn't got any guard up for her. I found her charming. And she seemed to kind of see that I was serious about what I did. And in that way that sometimes younger people are almost a little earnest. And I see that when I see the footage of it, it breaks my heart, because I think it was like a real... You know, there wasn't any sort of generational animosity or any of that nonsense. You know, it was like it was just genuine curiosity, somebody trying to do their job and me trying to do mine.
I'd like to ask you about, your writing, and I could ask you all day about your writing. I don't get to, but I think you're a great writer.
Thank you.
I think you're a great songwriter, but also I think lyrically alone, you're a great writer. But a puzzling one sometimes, or a challenging one sometimes, in that, on a couple dimensions. I'll start with the one. Just an artist slip and wind up world of a nervous tick. Your lyrics are full of extraordinarily clever and memorable and cutting phrases and imagery that's evocative and it's specific, and yet often the actual theme or the plot of a story is a little bit removed and enigmatic.
Opaque.
And I want to know, is that a choice? Is that you?
It is in some cases. I think there's a really obvious shift in the writing on the album Imperial Bedroom in 81. I knew I was doing it then. That's the first record I ever published the lyrics. Up until then, I didn't think that they should be written down. I felt that they needed to be heard at the same time as, you know, as the music. They weren't little poems. I could have written poetry if I wanted to. I used to write poetry as a kid, and I don't know whether any it was any good, but I mean, I knew how to write poetry. And I think poetry is the sort of use of words where music is heard but not is playing, isn't it?
Don't know.
That's one definition.
Yeah,
you know,
I've never heard that, but it makes sense.
I don't know who said that. Maybe I did.
Yeah.
You know, that where you sort of hear music that's evoked by the rhythm and the cadence of the words without there actually being a musical accompaniment. I mean, that's one possible definition of poetry. You know, and I never really put myself on that level. It's a very high art form. So I just wrote these things to be sung. And then I started to think, well, I like certain kinds of painting where there are more than one angle within the frame. Why can't a song replicate that? Mm. And cinematic cutting is like that. It fractures time. It goes backwards, and just the act of editing to, you know, you see it from one point of view and then you're through a door and then you see the person standing in there, all those things. I'd kind of referred to them in songs from as early as Watching the Detectives. Long shot of that jumping sign, visible shivers running down my spine. Cut the baby, take it off her clothes. Close up of the sign that says we never close. I mean, I'd use the stage or the film directions in the lyric. I've done that a few times. But those, I just sort of push it further. She's filing her nails while they're dragging the lake. She's watching the detectives. And then other songs came up that were just fairly, that were very straightforward. And I just wasn't very comfortable with the idea that I had to write, if I wrote about events that we all shared, rather than say about matters of the heart, then I was less comfortable with making the easy slogan about it. It just, what, I didn't feel it was my job to do that or to tell people what to think, but to maybe try and find that little story that underlines something that I had seen that maybe somebody else hadn't. Now that your picture's in the paper being perfectly admired, you can have anyone that you have ever desired. All you gotta tell me now is why.
Coming up after the break, Elvis Costello on the collaborations that make up much of his new album.
Burt was open to a different form of collaboration, a dialogue in music. Why would he need to do that? He's Burt Bacharach.
And if you want to hear this Elvis Costello conversation in its entirety, check out our podcast archive on Stitcher or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, designed to provide information about available home insurance options in one place. More information at progressive.com. Freakonomics Radio is supported by LifeLock. LifeLock with Norton works to help protect identities and the information on devices from cybercriminals. Learn more at LifeLock.com.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We've been speaking with Elvis Costello, the English singer and songwriter whose latest record is called Look Now. Several of its songs were intended for Broadway shows that he and Burt Bacharach were working on. They require a lot of different modes and moods of Costello's unique singing voice. Where did your tremolo come from? Is that what it's called? Tremolo, vibrato in your voice when you sing?
Don't look now. I saw you shoot that glass.
Did you always do that? Was it a conscious thing? Did you do it as a kid?
It's about three different factors. One is that I was aware of that way of singing.
From your dad's music? Or
He definitely listened to Billy Eckstine.
When I said goodbye, I'm sorry.
My dad, on some records that he made, he doesn't have a lot of records under his own name, but the few where he sings in his true voice, oddly enough, you can hear elements of Eckstine in his vocal delivery. And he's one of my mother's favorite singers, along with Tony Bennett. And, you know, ballad singers tended to use vibrato. The vibrato that might have been inherent in my voice, I think, wasn't so obvious because there were so many words in my songs. There were not many long-held notes in the early songs. They were mostly very quick fire. And when I slowed the pace down to sing ballads, then it became more apparent. And also simultaneously to that, I have to credit Chrissy Hynde with reintroducing the warm vibrato idea into popular music of the then time. I'm talking about 80 to 83, that period there, after, you know, she made her appearance about 79, 80. It reminded me of, like, the sounds that I loved about Dusty Springfield, who was probably my favorite singer at that time. I think beyond that, there's a certain amount the vibrato is a product of maybe a physiological. There are some.
Many I can't think, do it, right? Many singers can't do it.
Yeah, but I think also I think that part of it is physiological. I guess it's a flaw in my
in my
breathing that maybe my the whole engine works like that and it's. If you live with a something like a heart murmur, you're it can be like that.
She
You're saying your vibrato is a handicap of some kind?
It's not a handicap. It's a physiological fact.
Really? So yeah. You don't try?
No.
You don't try to put it on. Your voice does that.
I think the breathing, really? Does that, because I think it's like a limp. It's like a limp. You could make it. There are people who have great gaits, you know, that you remember. Like Robert Mitchum had a particular gait. Think of it like that. It's my John Wayne kind of gait, the vibrato. Just think of it like John Wayne, and you've got it.
But I thought the story you were telling me about Chrissy Hynde was that
I didn't suppress it then. I love Chrissy singing so much that I thought, well, okay, you can have that in modern pop music. Like you could have it in the 60s, like you know.
Because it was corny. I mean, if you'd heard it in the 60s, it would have been...
Yeah, but I don't think there's a single corny note that Dusty ever sang. I think there's certain, you know, if you hear some things from the 50s, they sound very over emotive. They sound kind of trumped up, but you know, they're just, and also, you know, some people can't hear opera. You know, they think that's ridiculous, and other people hear beauty in that way of singing.
How about you?
I hear really beauty in a lot of the opera singers. I mean, there's times when you go and it isn't good, and the people, but I know the physical dedication that goes into that. And if you listen to Chaliapin, or Hans Hotter, or Fischer Dieskau, or any of the great recorded singers. And then there's the people I've seen, my friend Anne-Sophie Van Otter. I mean, I was a fan of hers from just going to the concert hall to always hear her sing. And then we became friends and we made a record together.
Summer is gone, our love will remain, like all broken bicycles out in the rain. Motor cars, handlebars, bicycles for two, broken-hearted jubilee.
She wanted to make a record where she let go of some of the training of her voice, but, you know, she's incapable of singing an ugly note, you know, and of course, some of the things that are proposed in the singing of a popular song are sounds that are an anathema to a trained singer. So it's quite difficult for them to unlearn some of their training and to be unbuttoned enough to do it.
Do you still have the scream? Do you still scream ever?
Do I what?
The scream you used to do.
I can, yeah. I mean, I don't want to do it in here because it's loud. But
I don't mind, but I'm not going to try it now.
But I mean, it doesn't always, it's not something I was conscious of doing. It's not really thinking, oh, I better put a scream in there. It's just something you do. It's sort of a harmonic. I'm thinking in particularly in terms of the beginning of Man Out of Time. It sort of sounds like a alto saxophone playing harmonics. Mm-hmm. It's actually more than one note, you know. And I like that. When it came out, it all went squirrely, and it just like the, I love those things. I mean, there's different singers whose techniques are fascinated by. You know, I used to love Bobby Blue Bland, because he always used to say,
every time you cry, every time you cry.
He used to sound like he was clearing his throat. It sounded like, you know, and Al Green has a, and these are singers that have so much voice compared with me. I like singers who are kind of triers, like Rick Danko. Yeah. He sounded like there was kind of a nervous thing to the way he sang that I really loved, and it felt very human. And there's something very beautiful about that. And it's probably why we're able to respond to music in other languages without understanding what's being sung. We're maybe fascinated by where the emphasis lies in a kind of music that uses either a different rhythm or a different scale. So it's always surprising us. And the timbre of the voice is, you can tell there's a yearning in it, or a sense of joy, or a sense of lament. I can listen to religious music in the same way without necessarily believing the same thing that the singer is. Mm. I can listen to gospel music or cantors or, you know, whatever recordings. It's what the singer believes in. Mm.
Which of these songs would you say came to you most fully? And when I say fully, I mean maybe it's even just the idea or the instrumentation and not...
Well, the instrumentation, that's a different thing. Yeah. That the instrumentation and the orchestration of these songs was sort of more like they were very complete to me when the songs were finished. But then the minute I decided that we were going to do them as a band, then I also started to think of, like...
You're hearing the horns even in the strings.
I was hearing everything, really? And the vocal and the background voices, that, you know, the vocal arrangements, the string arrangements. The horn arrangements, they were all, to my mind, almost extensions of the composition. So as we arranged our parts, I wanted, you know, the whole point of the exercise was to sort of trust in my cohorts. We had gone out last year and looked at the songs from the album Imperial Bedroom, which the original band who played at the Attractions, two of whom play in the Imposters, we truthfully never had the patience to play many of those songs well. The ones that survived into our live repertoire were songs that were easily adapted to the way we more commonly played, which was more frenetic. And the other songs, which were quite detailed in the studio, we didn't have the patience for the little details and nuances, nor did we have the voices. Nobody could sing in that band except me. So we never had any vocal harmony on stage for the last, you know, 15 years or whatever it is. Davey Farragher has been in the band as a bass playing, a singer or singing bass player. So we've had two-part harmony, but we've also started to, you know, incorporate two other singers into the live. Yeah, so Kit and Corroy and Brianna Lee in this case, and on some songs, Davey's elder brother, Tommy. So we could have, between us, we could, Davey being a very good vocal arranger in his own right, although I sort of sketched out all the parts in my demos, Davey and I would then discuss what combination of voices is best used, just the same way as I didn't arrange every song for the same configuration of instruments. There's a bassoon on one song. There's a woodwind quintet where you might have expected to hear a string quartet. Though you could imagine them playing the same parts on stripping paper, but I wanted the sense of like something breathing, which the wind instruments brought. So that was.
You're hearing all that.
I was hearing that in my head, and then it's just something that I've learned over the years, which is, whereas I used to have to kind of, whenever I had something outside of the regular instruments of the band, I had to trust somebody to write it down. Sometimes it would get a little changed. Something would get lost in the translation. And in the early 90s, I learned how to write music down. I was, you know, it was. Quite
you didn't learn until then. I mean, no. You grew up knowing what music was. Reading
yeah, but
it
I never had any need to write it down because right. The sort of songs I started out with, they would be, in some ways, they would have been attenuated by writing them down. You had to feel them. But these songs, it was all a process of paring down the arrangements to the essentials in the rhythm section. And Steve Naive, who's been my cohort for nearly 40 years, I mean, he's a remarkable musician. I mean, he was a 19-year-old Royal College of Music student. So his education was obviously not complete there, but what he brought to the band and then what he's developed in all of the music, not just playing with me, but his own compositions. I mean, he wrote an opera, you know. I mean, he's explored things and piano records where he's followed his own instincts about music. He's the kind of person who can give you lots of invention to any theme you give him. But also you have to have some discretion about which part of what he's playing is really magical and which complements the song and which
are you
is
good
simply
at, is
filling.
He good at accepting that from you?
I think we worked. I think there are some times when I've just been inclined, just let Steve go. And when I think about it later, maybe I could have been more discerning. But it was so thrilling to hear him play, I didn't do that. So I'm not gonna retrospectively re-edit the records. Nearly all of the credit for the production should go to Sebastian Kreese.
Right.
He recorded it. He was the one that made sure the order was kept to things. He got the beauty of the sound. He mixed it. My contribution to the production was really in the editorial of the music, in that I had to be there, the discerning voice of anything there. I'd say to Pete, play a simpler fill or give me something different there if you can. Steve, leave this hole because there's going to be strings there and then you'll play together and the next time. Well, he couldn't know that because I hadn't told him.
So you don't let him play through then edit out. You decide.
Well, in some cases we would get in and he'd start to play and I'd say, we maybe need to leave more of a hole there or don't do that variation because it's not agreeing with what else is coming, because we did do everything separately. Most records I've done in the past, 90% of them have been arranged from the voice outwards. Right. So I would sing on the live take, and often that would be the take. So that would was a lot of pressure for the band, in that if I got something I liked, they would have to live sometimes with a flawed performance if you couldn't fix it in some way. In this case, I didn't want to do that. I wanted everything to be that we would agree what we were going to play and we would draw on everybody's strengths independently.
What was that experience like for you then as a singer?
Well, that's really like getting to my dream to be like Dusty, you know, of going in and like, if you see those old pictures of like where they had the band in the studio and the vocalist in the booth, that's what it felt like, because usually when you're singing in the studio, you're imagining, I'm going to add some stuff to this. And sometimes when you re-sing a song, it's because the weight of the original performance wasn't quite right. There's nothing the matter with the singing, but maybe it was too aggressive or not aggressive enough, or not forceful enough. And then when you add those other instruments, the vocal sounds muted. In this case, I had everything to support me. It was like being on stage with an orchestra or an ensemble.
I don't mean to be a shrink here, but to some degree, was it your father died a while back? Was
fulfillment. People said that when I worked with Burt Bacharach, yeah, because I wore a tuxedo, you know, but they'd never seen my dad in a caftan. You know what I mean? It was never psychological.
Yeah.
I'm not given to that kind of thing. I mean, I just enjoyed doing it this way. But equally, when I invited Burt Bacharach to play with the band, you know, we had written about 25 songs over the last 12 years for two musical projects, one of which was based on our original album, Painted from Memory. Now, it's quite difficult to thread a story through a group of existing songs unless it's a biographical show about the songwriter or the artist. And therefore, we ended up with another 10 or so songs written for Painted from Memory, but they were also very slow and melancholic, like the original collection, which I guess scared the producers that we were engaged with, and the show seemed to stall. And after a couple of years of no further movement, I asked Burt 2 years ago if he would consent to let me bring them out into the light, or the ones that I felt I could sing, because I just thought they were too good. I mean, I thought they were, you know, they were absolutely crazy for good songs. In the case of the two that he leads, they're all his music and I'm only the lyricist. One of the most amazing things to me and wonderful things is that Burt entered into a different kind of collaboration 25 years ago than he'd ever had. And he continued to return to that style of collaboration with me. Actually, I think uniquely, I don't think he's co-written music with anybody else, but maybe Neil Diamond. So that's pretty good company to be in. You know, Neil, who has written tremendous songs as well. But Burt was open to a different form of collaboration, a dialogue in music, which why would he need to do that? He's Burt Bacharach, you know. But that just shows the curiosity.
Hey, come on, you're Elvis Costello.
No, but it's not like that. It's like, you know, it has always been the beauty of this collaboration that on the one hand, you had somebody who was open to something different, despite all the experience, despite all of his achievements. And the second thing is, you can't get anything past him. Because he, you know, he hears everything.
And what was the song you said you sent to him and he said, nope, it's done? What was it?
Stripping Paper.
Yeah.
Because that was also written with view to being in this musical production.
Had you not become a musician, what do you think you would have done though, had it not worked out?
I just never had any doubt that I would do it something eventually. Mm. I never occurred to me.
When you say you didn't have doubt, meaning you had confidence that it would work, or you just didn't have an alternate idea?
I never had any. Oddly enough, it sounds really strange, but I didn't have any other ambition than just to do this.
I'm Stephen Dubner. Thanks to Elvis Costello for taking the time to speak with us. Thanks also to Mark Satloff for making it happen. If you missed any of our How to Be Creative series, our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive can be found on Stitcher or at Freakonomics.com. You can subscribe or get recent episodes on any podcast app. Thanks for listening.
Soon. Here's the pencil.